I may end up in a padded cell this afternoon.
There you go.
They're both retired lieutenant colonels from the U.S. Air Force, both experts in flight safety and mishap investigations, and they both have a sense of humor.
My wife's been pushing me to go to the doctor for the last 2 or 3 days, and she was elated that I made an appointment.
Jeff Thomas.
I feel better. So I canceled it, but I know she's going to come home and she is just going to wring my neck.
Dave Moore.
It's like if I didn't get a flu shot, my wife would have done the same thing. I just can't lie. I can't do it. Yeah, that's right.
Welcome to Flight Talk with Jeff and Dave, a podcast with stories and advice on flight safety brought to you by Strategic Results. I'm Ted Canova, and I'm just on board for the ride. We're doing a podcast on flight safety.
Good Lord, you know, after how many years has it been? Since 1970, I guess.
That was the last time you flew?
No, that's actually the first time I flew. After a while, you realize, you know something? Being safe up here is probably a good idea, because if God wanted us to fly, I think he probably would have given us wings. But since he didn't, we have to learn.
Based on our backgrounds, we've accumulated a lot of war stories over the years. And, you know, people might look at us and think, you know, you guys are unsafe. But then other folks would look at us and say, hey, why don't you share what lessons you've learned over the years from these different events? And maybe we can learn from them. You know, when I tell them I was trained right back before World War II, I kind of get the eyes roll off and, well, maybe we can't learn from them.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the bottom line is pilots are pilots, airplanes are airplanes. And over the years, the cause of mishaps hasn't really changed all that much.
That's right. We don't seem to find new ways of crashing airplanes.
The Air Corps put out a video in 1944, the Army Air Corps. And our accident rate obviously was very high during World War II. And I'm not talking about combat losses. I'm talking about training losses.
Just plain losses. That's right. And there were more of those than there were combat losses.
Well, yeah. One unit, the B-26 replacement unit at Tampa Bay, had a slogan, one a day in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, I heard that.
I would probably want to be the guy that flew later in the day. You know, if we already lost one, good. I'm good to go. They put out a video that had like the top 12 reasons that we were losing airplanes, and they knew they had to get their arms around it because we just couldn't sustain that loss rate. And if you watch that video today, like 11 of the 12 scenarios are still applicable.
Still with us.
You know, nothing's changed since World War II.
I was kind of catching up yesterday with some history here, and it was the Army first started to take accident statistics and so forth in 1921. The worst year was 1922, where we had 506 Class A mishaps, those are the worst kind, per 100,000 flying hours, and lost a lot of airplanes.
Gentlemen, between the two of you, Jeff, you are perhaps the most experienced lead investigator with the United States Air Force, and Dave, retired Lieutenant Colonel, you're probably one of the most senior pilots in all of the United States Air Force.
Well, when I retired in 2004, I was the oldest pilot on the base that was still flying airplanes, and one of the senior pilots in the Air Force at that time, yep. And I go back to the pilot training was 1971. The Air Force had these radial reciprocating airplanes. Those are the ones with spark plugs and cylinders and stuff. They were all over the place then, you know, and that's sure enough, I got plenty of time in those.
And Jeff, you go back and you had a love of airplanes when you were a little boy. Tell us about it.
My very first memories of anything are airplanes. But I remember at 3 years old, walking across the ramp at Boston Airport, and I don't know if it was called Logan at the time or not, on a red carpet, walking out to a large four-engine jet with a band playing under the left wing.
Wow.
Sailing ships in space. Can you imagine sailing ships in space?
And we climbed the stairs to first class, and off we went. And I remember walking up the stairs and looking down at the airplane and thinking just how big it was and how impressed I was at 3 years old. And I think that was kind of the start of it. It was the first Boeing 707 flight from Boston to San Francisco with the old the old water wagon engines, which I would love later in my career with the KC-135s.
It was a big thrill for me the first time I went to an airport. My brother was marrying a girl who came from Germany, and she was coming into to Idlewild. You know, it wasn't just an airport, it was Idlewild. I was thrilled. My fifth grade teacher let me out of school that day, and I went down to Idlewild to see the big airplanes coming in. Now, the big airplanes were four-engine airplanes with propellers on them. There were no jets. It was 1959. I guess there were, but I didn't see any that day. And in those days, you can go out on the observation deck, stand right outside, and you can feel the blast from those fans coming at you. But that was Idlewild. I was absolutely thrilled to be at Idlewild.
I wasn't even born when you guys are telling these stories, but my early recollection of flight was through my dad, who worked for both Grumman and Fairchild Hiller, and they on Long Island.
He made the lunar module. That's right. What a machine. It worked every single time.
If it goes more than 5 or 6 miles above the Earth, it scares me.
Yeah. But the lunar module, if you're on the surface of the moon, it simply had to work.
And not just it worked, but it then had to get the astronauts back up.
That's right.
To the command module.
That's right. The descent stage brought them down to the surface of the moon, and then the ascent stage, which is right on, which is just immediately above it, that had to work. Otherwise, they were going to be there for good. This is 1969 now.
So, gentlemen, you've got war stories to tell. You're gray-bearded experts. By your own account, the younger pilots may look at you and roll their eyes. What do you hope people learn, Dave, from this podcast?
The goal is to prevent mishaps. We don't use the term accident in the flight safety field in the Air Force. We use the term mishap. I guess because somebody thought, well, accident sounds like, well, there's nothing anybody could have done about it. But a mishap, we see them as preventable. The great majority are preventable, especially the real serious ones. And so that's what we hope to achieve. It's the preservation of the most precious assets in the United States, and i.e. that's the Air Force, the military anywhere, or airlines, for that matter.
And Jeff, as Dave talks about mishaps, of the two of you, you've had some close calls where you had to make split-second decisions on whether to eject or not. I think it happened twice, but at least share one of those harrowing experiences.
One was in a T-37 and one was in a T-38. And I wasn't a student at the time. I was fully qualified to fly both airplanes. You know, it kind of goes back to like thinking ahead and knowing your equipment and knowing the limitations of your equipment or what your equipment can actually accomplish. And one was a near ejection scenario close to the ground in the T-37. It's a long story. It involves a encounter with a microburst, which if you think of the size of the T-37, it must have been a very small microburst to have, you know, to be able to affect it. The T-37 is not a very big airplane. We used to say it looked like a Volkswagen Beetle with two ironing boards stuck out either side.
Yeah, in my day, it was 6,600 pounds of junk with two scared people inside of it.
Yeah, 6,000-pound dog whistle.
I heard that too.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of the T-37 and the microburst. And the airplane is getting pushed towards the ground, and it's looking pretty obvious like there's not going to be a recovery that's going to happen before we hit the ground. I remember thinking that we need to eject.
Ooh.
And very rapidly racing through the ejection, the parameters of the ejection seat. If we'd have ejected at that point, we would not have survived, because the seat didn't have the capability to do a close to the ground with a descent rate ejection. And again, that's really a matter of understanding your equipment and knowing how it works.
That's right. You're aware of that downward vector that would have caused you to die.
The bottom line is we didn't hit the ground. But the event probably took 20 seconds to unfold, but it would take me 20 minutes to explain to you everything that happened in that 20 seconds, because you just become hyper aware of everything that's going on during that time period, which is a kind of an unusual phenomenon.
Gentlemen, pleasure sitting with two of you with all of this experience. Yes, you've got some gray hair, but you've got some great hangar stories. So thanks for your time.
I don't have any gray hair. I'm bald.
Whatever hairs I have, they're gray.
We'll save that for another episode. Why you're bald and why you're gray.
That's right. I might be balder and I might even be grayer.
Thank you both.
All right, Ted.
Thank you, Ted.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Flight Talk with Jeff and Dave. a podcast with stories and advice on flight safety, brought to you by Strategic Results. I'm Ted Canova. See you next time.